from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
The difference between a political education and a politicized education is getting lost. There are parents all over the country concerned that their children are being taught a politicized or even an activist way of thinking about their participation as citizens.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Dr. Kathleen O'Toole, Assistant Provost for K-12 Education here at Hillsdale College. She's our first guest on today's program. We'll ask Dr. O'Toole to define for us what exactly is American classical education. Dr. O'Toole, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And the topic of our conversation today centers around the question, what is American classical education? Emphasis on the American. Something that makes us very American is our politics, our political system. I think a big question we should tackle is should we be teaching about those politics in school? And perhaps, first, what do we mean by politics in this educational setting?
Yes, right. And that is such an important question because education is becoming so political right now. I cannot think of a time in my own lifetime, maybe the last two or three generations, when education was more of an issue in the news. And what we're seeing in the news is that the difference between a political education and a politicized education is getting lost. There are parents all over the country concerned that their children are being taught a politicized or even an activist way of thinking about their participation as citizens. And so as an advisor to a network of schools that teach politics not in the politicized sense, but in the true sense, this is concerning, and it's important for us to be able to understand the difference. So here, I think, is what we mean when we talk about the teaching of politics in a classical school. You could also talk about it like the teaching of political philosophy in a classical school. Classical education begins from an observation about our human nature. It begins from the idea that whatever we do in school, it should be fitting to our human nature, which we regard as a kind of permanent or fixed thing. And it should happen in a way that encourages our human nature to develop in the right way. And so we don't regard students as, you know, unmolded clay that we can just shape into whatever. We think there are some certain given things about these children, and whatever we do with them in K through 12 should be fitting for them, both what they are now and what we hope they will become. So one of the things we regard as given is what Aristotle observes about us. He says, man is a political animal. And what he means by that is not man, you know, either reads the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal and argues on Twitter about it. What he means is we're made to live in communities with each other. In the politics, he explains why a full human life cannot exist if you're just by yourself, or even if you're just with your own family. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a political community to be with, you can't live well. You're too concerned with, you know, the daily needs of your body and of your safety, right? The political community kind of, by banding together with other human beings, we get the things that we need in order to be concerned with the higher points of life, rather than just, where is my next meal coming from? Why is it so cold outside? That's the first reason why we're political by nature. We need each other in order to live well. But Aristotle goes on to explain in the Ethics and also in the Politics that the political community is one area in which the fulfillment of our nature, not just meeting of the basic needs, but the fulfillment of our nature becomes possible. And that's because once you get a political community established, a group of people, there are going to be lots of questions about how are we going to run this thing? What kind of laws are we going to have? And those questions are really, really important because bad laws can do terrible things mm-hmm. to human beings, and good laws can do wonderful things for human beings.
We've talked a lot about the teaching of civics. We've talked a lot about making sure that our children become good citizens. Are these the kind of lessons, the type of knowledge needed to ensure those things are happening?
Yes. Yeah, I think the first ingredient of an education that prepares students for good citizenship is to kind of give them, over the course of their K-12 education, kind of a theoretical background like I just tried to provide. Like, politics is contentious. We exercise our human nature by participating in it. There are better and worse ways to do that. Virtuous people can do it in better ways. You should try to be a virtuous person. And if you can do that, it's good for you, and it's also good for the regime in which you live, which is good for you. First, I will say, I think for understandable reasons, a lot of teachers today are just, they don't want to touch it in the classroom.
Right.
And one of the things that you learn, or my teachers learned when I was in school, was don't bring your own views into the classroom. And that makes a lot of sense. You know, you have a lot of power as a teacher, a lot of authority in the classroom just from your presence there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say, well, of course I voted for so-and-so in the last election, the kids who like you are going to think that that so-and-so was a good person to vote for. And the kids who don't like you are going to think that so-and-so is not a good person to vote for. And that's not how we come to understand elections.
Mm-hmm.
So it is important not to become personal about it and to give them a real education. What it means instead is reading the books, reading the thinkers that will give you this theoretical foundation, which we do in the high school. We read Plato. We read Aristotle. We think about different political philosophers who have thought about different ways of arranging the regime and who have conceived of the role of the citizen in different ways. And from there, you can kind of, it gives you sort of a theoretical framework from which to understand your own experience, your own regime. And you can kind of evaluate it. Is it happening in a just way? Is it happening in an unjust way?
Talking with Dr. Katie O'Toole, Assistant Provost for K-12 Education at Hillsdale College. What makes the study of America at Hillsdale K-12 schools different?
We make sure students understand the nature of America. America is, if you study history, which our students do, you learn that America is unusual. The founding of America, as Federalist One says, happened in a way that was completely different from every other regime that happened before.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of smart guys who had been educated for their entire lives and who had been thinking about these questions, how do we bring about justice? What is the right way to structure a political order so that it is good for the individual and good for the community? Got together and they talked about it with each other. And the records of their conversations are available to us in the notes on the Constitutional Convention and in the letters that they wrote with each other. And so it was, as Publius says, it was a founding based on reflection and choice, not on accident and force. And that means that we can study it in school. And we have, it's relatively recent compared to the rest of history that we study.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a lot of evidence to consider. We have letters, we have the notes on the Constitutional Convention, we have the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution itself. And so that means that we can study our origins, and we can know through documents, not summaries of documents, but actual documents, what was happening at the time. What we learn by studying that is that they put a lot of thought into it, and they were really smart. Were they perfect? No. No one is, right? They're human beings. But what they accomplished was monumental and rare and precious mm-hmm. and fragile.
Dr. Kathleen O'Toole, Assistant Provost for K-12 Education at Hillsdale College, talking about what is American classical education. Dr. O'Toole, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, Dr. Jason Lepiarvi from Thornlow University will join us to talk about themes of C.S. Lewis's fiction. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're back. on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. To find out more about Hillsdale College, if you're a prospective student, alumnus, or friend of Hillsdale, head to hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Dr. Jason Lepiarvi. He is a fellow at Thornlow University, also a fellow in literature at the Davidson Institute, and you can find out more at studycslewis.com. Dr. Lepiarvi, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, good morning.
You are here on campus as part of our CCA lecture series on the Inklings, and a lecture that you're giving is Themes of Lewis's Fiction. So that's essentially what we want to talk about with you here today in the minutes we have together. Tell our listeners who are unfamiliar, what is this group, the Inklings? How did Lewis sort of become friends with them, and how did it impact his faith, his writing?
Well, the Inklings are a circle of Christian friends, Oxford-based intellectuals and professors and artists and writers and poets, who met for a number of years twice a week, once for over a pint and once for over tea, to discuss literature, faith, everything, and to read out what they had written in a circle of friends, and then critique each other charitably. And a number of people over the years were members of the Inklings. Somebody has called C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien the two sons of this system of planets around which all the other planets orbited. So they certainly were the center of the group. But Christianity was a criterion of friendship, or at least sincere interest in faith. And so it had a huge impact on everyone who ever attended it, whether they were there for a few times or for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And they were larger together. And you see each of their influence in the other's work.
On C.S. Lewis and his fiction, what are some of the constant themes that we would see if we read through Lewis's fiction?
That's a really difficult question. Lewis was once asked why, in a book, why he doesn't talk more about the content of poetry, and he's talking about the function of nature of poetry, but not the themes of poetry.
Hmm.
And he replied, well, so that's like asking, what do people talk about? Because people talk about everything. And so I'd say the same with Lewis's fiction and Lewis's writings overall. He wrote over 40 books during the course of his lifetime, everything between children's literature to science fiction, to philosophical treatises, to poetry. Thousands and thousands of published letters, and so he was interested in pretty much everything. There is a key theme, and I'm a little bit biased here because I've done some, I did my doctorate on the understanding of love in Christian history, and I'd say the Alliance share of everything he wrote about somehow is connected to love.
Looking at his fiction, looking at his nonfiction, can you draw some comparisons or contrast? Did he write in different ways when he was writing fiction versus nonfiction?
Not as much as you'd think. Lewis wrote for the ear, not the eye. And so many of the things that he wrote, they were meant to be lectures, they were meant to be spoken, and you get the sense of familiarity with, he's having a conversation with you, and he's making his intellectual, his academic stuff very accessible and entertaining. I laughed through some of his literary criticisms because he's so funny. And yet, the books that he wrote for popular audiences are always challenging. He's holding your hand, but at the same time, for many, he's just above your head. Just enough to keep you interested in growing and expanding. But he wrote, one could say, and I'm I'm simplifying here quite a bit, but he tried to write in two modes at the same time, and he used this metaphor of a beam of light. You're in a dark room, you're in a dark tool shed, and there's a hole in the wall, and there's a strong beam of light coming through that hole. So you have one vision. When you're looking at that beam of light, you see specks of dust floating in it. That's one way to look at things, analytical. The other way is to look along the beam, through the hole, and that transforms your vision completely. Mm. Now you don't see what you saw before. Now you see the sun. Now you see the trees, perhaps, maybe a bird. And so he was always trying to be analytical, but also immersed at the same time, so that you get a taste of the reality behind the flat, boring words.
What do you think makes Lewis's fiction writing still relevant, still interesting, 70 years-ish later after the fact?
Well, again, I'm simplifying, but I think that the answer is the same for all of his writing. It's style and content. So he writes so well. It's a bit dated at times in terms of language, mm-hmm. but he writes beautifully. So that's one thing that keeps people interested. The second thing is that he's very wise and, in a way, prophetic in many areas. And so he could anticipate what's happening in society. He knew a lot about history, so he had a sense of where this might go next,
sure.
if we don't do this or that. And so if you read his science fiction, for example, today... you'll be impressed by some of the themes there. I'm like, okay, this is a smart... He wrote this in the 40s? Really? So, style and content, I would say.
Dr. Jason Lepiavi, let me ask one final question as we talk about C.S. Lewis and his fiction. What set Lewis apart from his peers, perhaps even among his friends in the Inklings? What made Lewis different?
Lack of perfectionism. Perfectionism is a vice that stultifies, that kills productivity. And some of his friends, some of the other Inklings members, suffered from it. Mm. It's also a potential strength. But what made Lewis different was that he wrote so much. He had an incredible capacity for work and humility. Once it was written, he moved on to the next project. He didn't return to it over and over again, niggling it, perfecting it, like someone would a painting for a dozen years. So that's one of his secrets for sure, lack of perfectionism.
Dr. Jason Lepiavi, he is a fellow at Thurlow University and a fellow in literature at the Davidant Institute. You can also find more at studycslewis.com. You're on campus as part of our CCA lecture series on the Inklings. Dr. Lepiavi, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Up next, Brad Berzer from Hillsdale's History Department joins us to take a closer look at Andrew Jackson. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
At Shasta Regional Medical Group, we're focused on the health matters that matter to you, like having a primary care doctor you trust. Our physicians put patients first. They take the time to listen to your needs and concerns, and they provide the information you need to make good decisions about your own health. At Shasta Regional Medical Group, you have an integrated network of caregivers and specialists working to serve you in a compassionate, patient-centered environment. We're conveniently located right across the street from Shasta Regional Medical Center. To make an appointment, call Shasta Regional Medical Group today at 605-4260 or visit us online at ShastaRegionalMedicalGroup.com. Shasta Regional Medical Group. Your primary care is our primary concern.
I'm so celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
North State Relief, a nonprofit serving Northern California communities, is raising awareness that there are free financial counseling services available to North State residents, provided by certified counselors at Balance Pro. They offer free HUD certified financial counseling for debt, rental, and mortgage assistance, student loans, and financial counseling for veterans and fire victims. Get advice from the pros at balancepro.org or by calling 1-800-777-PLAN. That's 1-800-777-7526.
It looks like spring, the time of year for dust, pollen, busy birds, and bugs. The time to stop by Quick and Clean Car Wash at Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading. With car wash packages starting at only $9. Or buy 5 car wash coupons and get 1 free. Or buy 10 car wash coupons and get 3 free. Quick and Clean Car Wash is fast and convenient at Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading. Quick and Clean.
Aloha, this is Kevin, operations manager at Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. A professionally cleaned business sends a message to your paying customers. It says you are a company that cares about your image and always presenting the very best impression. Time after time, I've talked to clients who shopped for the lowest price and after a few months realized that their professional image was suffering. They didn't know who was actually coming into their offices to do the cleaning, and they just weren't getting the value they were paying for. Be wary of big-name companies that take your money, then hire unknown contractors to do the work. Since 1987, Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, your local professionals, have been offering the best in office cleaning by our screened, bonded, and insured staff. Take pride in your business and say aloha to your customers with the professional cleaning services from Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. Call 221-5868. 221-5868. MauiBob'sOfficeCleaning.com.
Lucky Miller's Deli and Market has moved to their new location at 2495 Athens Avenue, just north of Crown Motors and the Cypress Square Shopping Center. Choose from a tasty half-pound burger, pepperoni pizza, sandwich or hot dog with a side of fries, potato or macaroni salad, and dessert. Eat in or call 530-691-4333 to place your order or order online. Lucky Miller's Deli and Market has moved to 2495 Athens Avenue, north of Crown Motors and the Cypress Square Shopping Center, where our food speaks for itself.
Hi, this is Chuck Kent with Shasta Gas Propane. It's been a while since I've cut a new radio spot, but I feel I need to issue a warning about energy prices during this fall winter of 2021 and 22. Just as Obama said after he was elected, elections have consequences. This winter, our country will suffer some of the consequences of the last election. I'm not a politician, but I am a businessman, and many of the decisions of this current administration will drastically affect energy prices this winter and going forward. Already, we are experiencing record-high propane costs and prices. Remember, our motto at Shasta Gas Propane is, "Our customers are warm friends." We will treat you like friends this winter and do our best to help you through this high-priced winter. Give us a call at 365-3793. That's 365-3793.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out our redesigned website at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. You can find older episodes there, find our radio affiliates, and also sign up to receive an email every time there's a new episode. radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Dr. Brad Berzer, Professor of History, and Russell Amos Kirk Chair in American Studies here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Berzer, thanks for joining us.
Oh, Scott, always great to talk to you. You're one of my favorite colleagues, so anything, this is great.
That's so
nice.
And you're one of my favorite colleagues, so it's wonderful when we can get together and do this. We talk today, though, about President Andrew Jackson.
Tell us, Dr. Berzer, first about Andrew Jackson's life, say, before the presidency. What should we know about it? What kind of general was he, too?
Well, he's an absolutely fascinating character, Scott, in every way. There's just nothing uninteresting about this man. Comes from a very old Scotch-Irish family. Like many Scotch-Irish, they were poor but extremely hardworking, somewhat Calvinist/Presbyterian. They had those kind of strong Calvinist work values, the kinds of things that would be celebrated or at least either celebrated or mocked centuries later. But he had that strong understanding of who his family was, mm-hmm. what he was trying to do, what his kin network was. He comes out of that and really is of our presidents. He is the last president to have fought in the American Revolution, but he had fought. He was a 12, 13-year-old at the time that he was actually fighting in the American Revolution. So young boy lost all of his family during that time, and then kind of had to raise himself. There was some extended kin groups that helped raise him, but yeah. And you asked what kind of general he was. You know, he tried his hand because he was what I would call a small R Republican, not a Republican in the sense of the Republican Party, but a strong believer and a citizen in the Republic itself. And so he had tried all different aspects of the Republic. He was a legislator for a while. He was in the House. He was in the Senate. He tried to be a judge. None of that really suited him. He didn't have the temperament for any of that. And then he got appointed to be the head of the Tennessee Militia. And it was clear, this was right around 1799, 1800, it was absolutely clear that this is what this man was made for. And that kind of executive understanding of government, that executive understanding of life, and doing his duty as a Republican citizen, that really came together for him as a general in the Tennessee Militia. And then his whole life, and we could get into this, Scott, but his whole life was always this odd mixture of being both very private and very public. So even when he was head of the Tennessee Militia and later when he was a general in the U.S. Army, he really thought of himself more as a leader of free men of militias than he did as an actual officer of an army, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
These were definitely his men. They were free men. They were fighters. They were Republicans. And that's how he saw his men when he went into battle.
Andrew Jackson, president from 1829 through 1837. Tell us a bit about the buildup to his election in 1828. Why did Jackson run for president? What animated him?
Yeah, so he never ran, right? And that was kind of a conceit of the time that nobody would run for the presidency. You were ran. So we have to use the passive construction for that. In fact, mm-hmm. To be someone who would run for the presidency would have been considered an extremely, gosh, almost tyrannical way of thinking, because anyone who would seek an office like that, right, clearly didn't deserve it. But it's a conceit. And obviously he was running for the presidency, as was John Quincy Adams and others as well. But they had to make it look like they were being run rather than they were running it themselves. And in 1824, he went up against John Quincy Adams, and I actually consider this one of the great tragedies in American history, Scott. These guys had been amazing allies mm-hmm. during the Monroe administration. You've got John Quincy Adams, probably our best Secretary of State ever, that we've ever had. I take that from my colleague Paul Marino, but I think Paul is absolutely right. We have never had a better Secretary of State. You know, this is a guy who negotiates with Spain, he negotiates with France, he negotiates with Britain. He's a bulldog. You don't want to mess with John Quincy Adams. He's the reason we have this great border with Canada. Yeah, all of this is really because of John Quincy Adams. But he couldn't have done it, and Adams knew that. He could never have done it without Andrew Jackson being in the field. And they were a great team, though ironically they didn't really know each other. Andrew Jackson read the situation wrong. He thought that John C. Calhoun was his ally in the Monroe administration, and it was exactly the opposite. Calhoun was undermining him everywhere, and Jackson was convinced that Adams was his enemy. So a lot of things come out in 1824 unexpectedly, where you've got this real personality divide between someone like old, blue blood John Quincy Adams and upstart kind of lower middle class Andrew Jackson, and they think that they've got this weird history with one another. It explodes. It's a disaster of an election. And John Quincy Adams, through a whole series of very bizarre events, becomes president. And it's not only a tragedy that he breaks with Andrew Jackson on this, but it's a tragedy he becomes president, because this is a man who was an excellent Secretary of State. He will be an excellent representative in the House of Representatives. He's not a good president. It was a bad time for America overall that he became president, and it was bad for him.
Andrew Jackson, would it be accurate, do you think, to say that he was our first Western president?
Yeah, you know, I think this is one of the most important things we have to recognize about him. He's not only our first real Scotch-Irish kind of lower middle class person to come into the presidency, but he is also really our first frontiersman to be president as well. You could say that George Washington was certainly shaped by the American frontier, but of course he's born into money, and his frontier experience is the plantation. It's not like what we have with Andrew Jackson, where Andrew Jackson is really going out as an Indian fighter, as a surveyor, as someone who's creating, he more or less helps create Nashville, which would have been the ultimate frontier town at that point. Mm-hmm. And I think if we misunderstand Andrew Jackson and don't see him as a frontiersman, we're going to miss a lot about him, because it shapes his own attitude, not only towards his fellow white Americans, but it does towards the American Indian. It does towards American blacks. Certainly he sees himself as a figure kind of carving America out of the wilderness. And I think that's really important to understand him.
When we look at Jackson's time in the presidency, Brad, what would you say are the key items, the key stories that really marked his time in office?
Well, you see, there's the good and the bad. And with Andrew Jackson, you know, you're always going to have both. And he himself will admit when it's good and when it's bad. He's an incredibly honest person. He's brutal. He's incredibly violent, but he's equally honest. And when he comes into the presidency, there are several issues that are critical and for him and for the country as a whole. One, of course, is the question they would have called the Indian problem. What do we do with the American Indian? What do we do with the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, the Creek, the Seminole? You know, what happens with them? Because here we have these very, very civilized, you know, using, again, Republican terms from the time, we have Indians who are essentially Republicans, small-R Republicans, who are living the life that we kind of desire. We think that, you know, basically everything that they've done correctly, and yet they're still, quote-unquote, in the way. And that's a problem. It's a major problem, and there's no easy solution to that. The other great question at the time that Andrew Jackson had to deal with was, what do we do with our economic institutions, mm-hmm. especially the bank? Should we have a private bank, or really would be private banks, plural, multiple banks, or do we want this under the control of the federal government, or do we want some kind of what they would have then called capitalism? Do we want U.S. government harnessing capital and working with capital so that you would have business and government in alliance? So there are a number of great issues that Jackson has to deal with, but those are really the two most important. What do we do with our monetary system and our economic system, and what do we do with the American Indian?
Brad Berzer, hold on right there. We'll come back and talk more about Andrew Jackson in just a moment, asking the question, what exactly was the Trail of Tears? How was Jackson involved? I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Veterans, did you know that Shasta County Veterans Service Office is open to all veterans who have served our nation? Whether a combat veteran or a member of the reserves with limited active duty time, you have earned benefits. If you have any military benefit or veteran-related questions, call 530-225-5616 or stop by Shasta County Veterans Service Office at 1855 Shasta Street, Redding, California. This message is brought to you by Korean War veteran Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary, California Veterans Affairs.
Just in time for Mother's Day, from cottage to culture, whimsical garden accessories, and fashionable jewelry, including pendants, pins, and pearls, you'll find them at Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage in the Shasta Gateway Center in Anderson. Open Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from 10 to 6, Sunday noon to 5, closed on Tuesdays. Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage, 1773 Highway 273 in the Shasta Gateway Center in Anderson. Call 530-365-1399. That's 530-365-1399.
Retirement may seem to be in the distant future, or it may suddenly arrive overnight. At Stifel Investments, we are committed to working closely with our clients. Planning tomorrow means understanding the challenges of today. Uncertain markets, rising costs, and longer lifespans. As a financial advisor of 25 years, I'm committed to helping my clients achieve retirement success. Let's get started today. This is Susan Eastman, Stifel Nicholas & Company, 244-7199.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Hi, my name's Nick Gardner. I have a show here on KCNR. Sunday mornings from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. every other Sunday. The name of my show is Poke the Hornet's Nest.
There's no mountain I can't climb. There's no tower too high. No plane that I can't learn how to fly. What do I gotta do to get through to you to show you there ain't nothing I can't take this chainsaw to?
I'm going to concentrate on local politics mainly, but we'll talk about national politics also. You'll get the view of the common citizen here in Redding, California. And remember, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Maybe it's a good time for a new perspective about what's been going on in our town, in our state, in our nation. I hope you tune in and hear the other side of the news.
Everybody!
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere Ag and Turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
30 years ago, Simpson University arrived in Redding with a promise to serve the North State. Warmly welcomed by this far Northern California community, we forged lasting partnerships, serving our neighbors locally as well as globally. Building on our promise, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Our promise to be the gateway to world service begins in our backyard. Learn more about Redding's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Aloha, this is Kevin, Operations Manager at Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. A professionally cleaned business sends a message to your paying customers. It says you are a company that cares about your image and always presenting the very best impression. Time after time, I've talked to clients who shopped for the lowest price and after a few months realized that their professional image was suffering. They didn't know who was actually coming into their offices to do the cleaning, and they just weren't getting the value they were paying for. Be wary of big-name companies that take your money, then hire unknown contractors to do the work. Since 1987, Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, your local professionals, have been offering the best in office cleaning by our screened, bonded, and insured staff. Take pride in your business and say aloha to your customers with the professional cleaning services from Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. Call 221-5868, 221-5868, MauiBob'sOfficeCleaning.com.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with Brad Berzer, professor of history at Hillsdale College and also author of the book In Defense of Andrew Jackson.
Brad, let's talk about the Trail of Tears, the thing that perhaps is most linked to Andrew Jackson's name and his presidency. So this deals with the, as you mentioned, the language of the time, the Indian problem, as you just pointed out. What was the Trail of Tears? How was Jackson involved?
He's intimately involved, though the official Trail of Tears actually occurred under Martin Van Buren, his successor, rather than under Jackson. But that doesn't excuse Jackson at all. And this is one of those times where, when we're looking at Jackson, no matter how much we might like him or appreciate his honesty, he's probably pretty wrong about this. And it was a disaster. Let me give you one example with the Choctaw Indians, who were one of the first to be removed, and they were removed in 1830-1831. And there were, when we start out, if you go to 1830, on the eve of removal, so removed from Mississippi and Georgia and forcibly removed to Oklahoma, when they are removed, so this would have been in Andrew Jackson's first term, they started off, and I don't have this exactly right, Scott, but I'm only off by a little bit, they would have had roughly about 18,000 members of the Choctaw Republic. So, and now that's a mixed bag. I mean, you've got men, women, children. You've also got a lot of slaves. Nobody owned more slaves per capita than these American Indians did. And I think that's not to condemn them, but I think if we're really trying to understand history, mm-hmm. we have to understand, you know, this is not a situation where, oh, great Native Americans who clearly live with nature and are pristine. These are Southerners. Mm-hmm. These are Southern Indians. They're Southerners, and that's important as well. But when they are removed, 18,000 of them, roughly a year later, we have only a little under 7,000 left. It wiped out almost 60% of the population. That is inexcusable by any measure. It's just to go from 18,000 members in your society to a year later to about 7,000. And that's in large part because the removal took out about a third of the Indians, because the removal was so brutal during the winter months. Mm-hmm. And then when they arrived in Oklahoma, all of the things that they'd been promised by the U.S. government, timber, everything that they would need, lumber to make homes, to be ready, none of that was there. So not only is removal brutal, but they get to their place in Oklahoma. There's nothing waiting for them. The Indians who are there, Indians like the Comanche and the Apache, have no love whatsoever. They don't think, oh, my red brethren, here you've come. Right? They see white people, and they hate them. So this is just a disaster in every way, and there's just no excuse for it. And clearly Jackson is a part of this. Now, to his credit, he did firmly believe that these Indians had to be removed out of harm's way from Southern white Americans. And he thought this was the best solution, but the data shows it wasn't. It was a terrible solution.
Brad, you've literally written the book on Jackson. It's called In Defense of Andrew Jackson, and listeners can go pick that up. But why do you think then that Jackson deserves defending, as the title of your book says?
Yeah, you know, that wasn't my title, and I have to take blame for it because I accepted the title. It was the publisher's title. And I wanted something else like, and I'm not good with titles, Scott, at all. John Miller always makes fun of me, as he should. Our colleague, beloved John Miller, loves to tease me about this. I'm just not good at him. But I wanted something like exactly what you asked earlier, Andrew Jackson, First Frontier President, something mm-hmm. like that. And I do believe in defending him. I mean, in a sense, because, well, in more than one sense, I wanted to defend him because I think he's become a caricature. Mm-hmm. And this is to his credit in a way. He was such a powerful figure. You know, we call his era the Age of Jackson. And that says something. This was an incredibly charismatic man. And that means in good and bad, we can say all of the good of that era, look, the Age of Jackson. But we can also say, look, all the bad of that era, the Age of Jackson. Mm-hmm. And so Jackson, because he was such a larger-than-life kind of frontier hero, you know, I like to equate him to kind of John Wayne as Ethan Edwards in The Searchers, or John Wayne as Johnny Ringo in Stagecoach. Mm. You know, these very morally mixed and yet innocent kind of American figures that only America really produces. And I wanted to give Jackson his say. So if it's defense, I kind of thought of myself as his defense attorney. It's like, all right, let's talk about it. Well, there's good and bad. This is what he did that was good. This is what he did that it was bad. So the defense was not necessarily to say, look, here's a pristine Lilly figure who should never have been criticized,
mm-hmm.
but rather let's treat him as a human being, and he becomes a mythic figure, but why? What is it about him that is both good and bad? And so that's what I wanted to explore in the book. And hopefully that came across. But if I could do that book over again, there are definitely things I would add to it and change to a certain degree.
In preparing for the book, you read hundreds of pages of Jackson's own letters and writings. What did you learn specifically from those? How did Jackson see himself?
He is truly, of all the figures I've studied, and I'm talking the good guys. I don't mean Stalin and Hitler, but of the good guys I've studied, people that I really, really like, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, Charles Carroll, Abraham Lincoln, the figures in American history, these guys who make up Americana, I have never encountered a more honest person. I truly believe, and I think this was his Presbyterianism, I think it was his Scotch-Irish background, I think it was his mother, I think it was his wife. Andrew Jackson was incapable of being dishonest. Now, that doesn't mean he's always good, right? he may shoot you, but he's going to tell you beforehand he's going to shoot you. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a negative to that honesty, too.
Right.
But there's also a virtue in it. He just was incapable. I don't think that he, as a man, I mean, truly as a man, as a person, as Andrew Jackson, I don't think he could have lived with himself if he had lied or been dishonest. That's the kind of person he was. And, again, that could be bad at times. It doesn't excuse him from his sins, but he was very open about his sins. He knew who he was. He knew what he was. He knew what he stood for. And it's hard, at least for me, Scott, it's hard for me not to be attracted to that. If nothing else, I felt like as I was reading his letters, and I'm a fast reader and I love reading, but as I was going through his letters, I thought, this is not a complicated guy. This is a very open guy. I don't have to read between the lines. What he says is what he believes. He may have been wrong, but he believed he was right. And that's what I found so fascinating about him.
Brad, during his presidency, Donald Trump often referenced Andrew Jackson, spoke approvingly of Andrew Jackson. Having studied and written about Jackson so thoroughly, do you think there are some similarities there?
They both come out of this very anti-Washington establishment. Trump, in so many ways, dealing with regulations, in that he reminds me a lot of Andrew Jackson with Andrew Jackson and the bank. But it is amazing to me that they both come out of this moment of kind of a, Washington, you've gone so far, you've gone too far, you can't do this, you've ignored everybody in places like South Dakota and Kansas and Wyoming, and you've only catered, Washington has, you've catered not only to your own imperial city, but to the coast and the population centers, you can't do that. Jackson did that as well. Jackson spoke for all the new people who had settled in places like Michigan and places like Illinois and Indiana, places that he had opened up through his own victories during the War of 1812, and then these Americans settled those places that are open through the War of 1812, and then they turn around and give Jackson the presidency, and he does clean house. I mean, there is no doubt Washington is not the same place in 1837. Than it was in 1829. Jackson was fierce about this. You know, he cleaned up bureaucracies. He fired anyone who was using government money inappropriately. He really did completely change Washington bureaucracy.
Dr. Brad Berzer, professor of history, and Russell Amos Kirk, chair in American Studies here at Hillsdale College, talking about Andrew Jackson. Dr. Berzer, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
My pleasure, Scott. I always love talking to you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Kathleen O'Toole, Assistant Provost for K-12 Education at Hillsdale College, telling us about American classical education. Dr. Jason Lepiarvi on C.S. Lewis. And we also heard from Brad Berzer from Hillsdale's History Department on Andrew Jackson. You can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Podcasts, and also iHeart. Just search for The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Follow us on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or find us on Facebook. Email us, radiohour@hillsdale.edu. The assistant producer of the show is Nate Esbenshade. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Proven experience, fighting for you.
This is Stephanie Bridget, your Shasta County District Attorney. I've spent 2 decades fighting for your safety. I've personally prosecuted murderers, rapists, and child molesters, sending them to prison for life. I have met with and advocated for thousands of victims, giving them a voice against those that have harmed them. I am tough on crime and support a bigger jail. Vote for me, Stephanie Bridget, on June 7th.
Paid for by Stephanie Bridget for District Attorney 2022.
I'm Ed Rollman, a third-generation Shasta County native, business owner, and founder of the Merchants Crime Watch. District Attorney Stephanie Bridget has a 20-year proven record of fighting for the safety of Shasta County, including protecting local businesses from repeat offenders. That's why I support her re-election. We don't need someone like her opponent, a workers' comp lawyer with no experience who will need on-the-job training. Vote Stephanie Bridget for Shasta County District Attorney.
Paid for by Stephanie Bridget for District Attorney 2022.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
We need all units to
crime right.
California under siege.
Gang related.
Criminals set free.
Their local police.
Police attacked.
In shooting victims.
Victims ignored.
I shot my little brother.
Ultra-liberal California Attorney General Rob Bonta has never personally prosecuted drug traffickers or violent gang members. He has zero experience to do the job. Nathan Hochman does. Nathan is the one candidate for Attorney General endorsed by the California Republican Party. He's the only candidate with the real experience to keep us safe. As Assistant U.S. Attorney, Hochman prosecuted corrupt government officials and locked up violent drug traffickers and gang members.
I'm Nathan Hochman. What's happening in California is unacceptable. Politicians ignore us while communities are attacked. As Attorney General, I'll actually do the job and prosecute criminals. I will always protect California first.
Nathan Hochman, an attorney general who will keep us safe.
Paid for by Nathan Hochman for Attorney General 2022.
At Shasta Regional Medical Group, we're focused on the health matters that matter to you, like having a primary care doctor you trust. Our physicians put patients first. They take the time to listen to your needs and concerns. And they provide the information you need to make good decisions about your own health. At Shasta Regional Medical Group, you have an integrated network of caregivers and specialists working to serve you in a compassionate, patient-centered environment. We're conveniently located right across the street from Shasta Regional Medical Center. To make an appointment, call Shasta Regional Medical Group today at 605-4260. Or visit us online at ShastaRegionalMedicalGroup.com. Shasta Regional Medical Group. Your primary care is our primary concern.
Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance is now open at 3673 Eureka Way. Physical therapists Kevin Elo and Rachel Lang have a combined 29 years of experience in helping those who've suffered orthopedic injuries, strains, and sprains. Kevin has worked with the USA Gymnastics team, NFL Combine, and professional BMX riders. He's also helped members of Cirque du Soleil get back into action. Rachel works closely with seniors and is also a group fitness instructor and adept at returning people to an active lifestyle. Both Kevin and Rachel at Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance are accepting new clients. Give them a call today, 530-533-5030. If you are in need of physical therapy, talk to the experts at Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance at 3673 Eureka Way. Call 530-533-5030. That's 530-533-5030 today.
Convert your calling into a career at Shasta College this summer. Get a jump start on being transfer ready or boost your current career skills quickly and affordably with a certificate or degree. Our summer sessions offer flexible class times and formats with online and some in-person offerings. Plan a cool summer of hot classes by enrolling at Shasta College today. Summer session classes begin June 13th. Achieve more, earn more at shastacollege.edu. Enroll online today.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.